You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome to Cult from the Embassy. It's Thursday, January 18, 2018. I am your host, Alamdi Alanion, a staff writer at the Embassy. It's currently 9.02 a.m. The show is broadcasted from CITR 11.9 FM, the University of British Columbia's student newspaper, and we talk about what's going on in the university's culture scene. We also talk to the creators and creatives involved in various projects around town. This week on the show, I talked to Bridget Chase about the very cool transformation mask and the mysterious artist behind it. I also talked to Zach Vissera. He gave us the lowdown on one of the most anticipated plays of the year. And then I talked to Sam Dubois, who's our culture editor, and he fills us in on what's coming to culture in the weekly day-to-day production, the culture section's new style advice column, and the UBC's much-anticipated magazine. But first, I'm going to bring Bridget Chase with our talk about the Transformation Mask exhibit. Here's the show. So last year, the UBC Museum of Anthropology hosted this really cool exhibit called Transformation Mask. The project was put together by Sean Hunt and it was in collaboration with Microsoft, a software giant. The art that was showcased explored the intersection between art, tradition, and technology. I'm with Bridget Chase, a staff writer from the UBC, who wrote the piece about the exhibit and the artist behind it. Welcome to the show, Bridget.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Cool. So yeah, the name Transformation Mask sounds mysterious and cryptic in a little way. It really gives you no idea of what the exhibition is about. So could you kind of give us a primer of what it is?
Of course, yeah. So the Transformation Mask is actually a pretty classic piece of Indigenous art. Transformation masks are generally used in ceremony, and it's supposed to kind of be a way for a human to put on the mask and use it in a song or a dance and transform. A lot of transformation masks that we see in museums are not used in this way, obviously. They kind of sit on shelves or behind glass. And so the transformation mask that Sean created for this piece was very interactive. That was the first thing about it. So when you go into the exhibit, you actually get to put the mask on, and then it's basically a kind of a technological experience. So the mask opens up, and then it uses HoloLens technology, which he collaborated with Microsoft on, to present to the audience or the person that's wearing the mask a sort of kind of holographic artistic animation that appears in front of you. And it's this interesting blend of kind of classic Indigenous storytelling that happens in front of you alongside actually being in the mask that gives the user this very interesting cultural and traditional experience while also blending in that technology.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very, very cool.
Yeah, so it turns out that, like, the artist behind this is kind of like also mysterious as well. Could you kind of like tell us about the creator, Sean Hunt?
Yeah, so Sean Hunt is a really, really interesting guy. He is very well known in the art world in terms of Indigenous art. He's been practicing for over 10 years. He did a apprenticeship with Lawrence Paul. He also worked under his father, who's a very well thought of artist. But he is a very mysterious guy. When I went to try and do this interview for the UBC, he couldn't be reached for a long time. Actually, I really wanted to do this interview, and it was kind of hard to get a hold of him. But and he requested that he didn't want to do it over the phone because he kind of wanted to give some time to think about his answers, was his reasoning. But once I kind of contacted him via email and we did the interview via email, he gave some really amazing insight into his own process, into working with Microsoft, and into kind of Indigenous art as a whole and where it's progressing.
Cool. So let's just get back to like the transformation mask itself. Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the story that this piece is quite different from what Hunt has done before. Could you kind of talk about the origins of the piece and how it differed from the other stuff he's done before?
Yeah, of course. So Hunt actually originally started out by making jewelry, but during his kind of school years, he focused around sculpture. And then around 2008, 2009, he took up painting, and that kind of now is his usual medium. He goes back and forth between painting and sculpture. That's what he usually does. And so to have a piece that really strays from this and blends like a very new technology that we're just beginning to see, not only in art, but just in kind of modern day, it's really very interesting what he's done.
Cool, thank you. Why did Hunt choose to present the piece the way he did? What were like his intentions? What was he trying to convey?
So he talked about how he was always very interested in the ancient and modern push and pull within his work. And he really wanted to use technology to kind of create a new way of sharing traditional Heltzik culture and stories with a younger crowd as well, because we know young people are very interested in technology. And also he wanted to create a mask that was interactive and was able to be used in a way that a lot of transformation masks in museums aren't.
Cool. Thank you. What were like any lessons you learned in the reporting of this piece?
I learned that not all people are going to be easy to get a hold of.
Yeah.
I also learned a lot about Indigenous art. I do work with Indigenous communities myself, so I know a little bit, but going into the piece and doing research about kind of how Indigenous art is progressing and what people are doing, what new technologies are being used. And then also I learned a lot about Microsoft's the Garage. I never knew that it was even a thing that existed.
What is that?
So Microsoft has kind of a makerspace called the Garage.
In Vancouver?
Is in Vancouver.
Okay.
And it just has basically a whole bunch of cool technology that I don't know who can be invited to it, to be honest. I kind of want to figure it out.
Oh, you have to be invited.
You do, yeah. So he was invited to come, and basically, from what he told me, he didn't really have a piece in mind. He just kind of looked at all of the cool technology that they had available, all the different projects they were working on, and then he was like, this is kind of a cool idea. Maybe we can combine these things. And Microsoft apparently was totally on board. And he talked about as well how he would like to collaborate with them again. He hinted that maybe that was going to happen soon.
Like a little sneak peek.
Yeah. He gave a little intrigue at the end of the end of the article.
Cool. One of the cool things you kind of noted in the story is like Hunt's statement that Indigenous artists have always kind of embraced new technologies and when creating artwork. So could you kind of talk a little bit more about that?
Definitely. I think that Indigenous art as a whole, a lot of people look at Indigenous art, Indigenous culture, Indigenous language, and kind of place it in the past. But I think that it's really simplifying what it is. And the tools, the mediums, the concepts behind Indigenous art have continued to progress. And I think that it's really important that we look at it in a modern perspective and not just place it kind of in a historical perspective as often we might think to do.
Yeah, thank you, Bridget. So anything else to add or insights, observations, comments?
I definitely think that we should keep looking out for Sean Hunt. I think he's going to do some really interesting things in the future. And I also think that we should look out on the horizon for more new art that's coming up that is blending these sorts of technologies, because I think it's really, really cool. And I also think that it's a really interesting way that I think art is going to go.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Bridget Chase talking about her article on the Transformation Mask exhibit that took place at the MOA Museum of Anthropology at UBC last year. You can find the article on ubc.ca. Up next, we'll talk to Zach Vissera, a writer for the UBC, about the hot new play, She Kills Monsters. It's one of the most, big works of theater, probably, that UBC has ever done in a while. So It's going to be interesting. We'll be right back with after these PSAs and ads. All right, bye.
Hey! Yeah, no, I'm just at Shindig.
That was a really inspiring set.
CATR and Discorder's Battle of the Bands, they've been hosting it pretty much all year at the Hastings Mill Brewing Company, formerly known as Past Pub, every Tuesday night. It's the semis. Yeah, well, there are 27 bands and 27 winners, but these guys really aren't playing around to take the Shindig crown from last year's winner, Little Sprout. Yeah, coming out. You could win a free beer at Jokes or Beers and watch these bands battle it out for some rad prizes provided by our sponsors.
Silver Fox Postering, Nimbus Recording, Cannery Brewery, Pandora's Box, Betamaster Studios, Rain City Recorders, Mint Records, Music Waste, Live from Thunderbird Radio Hill, Hastings Mill Brewing Company, Sixth Cent Press, Blue White Studios, and Print Print.
The third round of semis is January 23rd. It's Basic Instinct, Pleasure Blimps, and Sorry Edith. Yeah, see you there.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
National Museum's Hastings Park 1942 exhibit marks the 75th anniversary of Japanese-Canadian internment. Visit the exhibit until January 13th to see Japanese Problem, a contemporary performance piece which offers a glimpse into a dark episode of history at the Pianese Livestock Barn. Nikkei National Museum is located in Burnaby and entry is by donation.
Welcome back. You're listening to Cult at the UBC, a culture show from the campus newspaper at the University of British Columbia. We're broadcasting to you from the unceded Musqueam territories on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Olamide Olanion. Right now, we'll plug into our conversation with Zach Vissera about She Kills Monsters, a play which premieres January 18th, tonight, if you're listening live. So stay tuned. Don't go away. It's going to be a treat. All right. Enjoy.
Bonsoir mes amis, ici Zach Vachera. Ce soir, on va discuter le nouveau spectacle de UBC Theater, She Kills Monsters, par Kini Yuen. Je suis rejoint par Ola Millier. On va avoir une discussion merveilleuse ce soir. Du coup, merci de nous rejoindre.
Jesus, yeah. So, yeah, that's Zach Vissera. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, this is Zach Vissera. Yeah,
the most incredibly cultured. How many articles do you even write in a week? Like, I don't know, like you're like probably like the more proficient and more, what do you call it? Yeah, proficient.
Productive. I would never normally consider myself productive. I like to write at least an article a week for the UBC as much as I can. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. Sometimes I don't write any articles and I'm just chilling, you know? But we all do the best we can over there. So good team. Solid team at the UBC.
Yeah, I'm just going to do introductions right, like, very well. Like, yeah, this is Zach Vissera, staff writer, senior staff writer, actually, for the UBC.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big boy now.
Big boy. He's wearing his big boy pants right now. Actually wearing, like, very
they
nice
actually
pants
are
right
two sizes too big. If anyone has any jeans that are size like 32, like please sell them to me. These are a bit too big and it's cramping my style a bit, you know?
Yeah. And now we just debuted as a bilingual show, so I have to like bring you on more often and just like
have you speak. You say the Canada, en français, you know? We're doing our thing. Yeah, we're doing our thing.
Comme ci, comme ça, you know?
Yeah, it's all good.
Oh, man. Okay. Cool. Okay, so this play coming out actually like tomorrow? And it's called She Kills Monsters, right?
Yeah.
And it's being directed by Kelty Forsyth, who's a returning director from UBC, right?
So, you got it.
Yeah, you talked to her and just like a bunch of other like culture staff writers also talked to like actors and, you know, just people involved with the play. So could you just kind of like start from the top? Could you tell me about the play?
Give it a breakdown.
Like give me like
about
a spoiler-free synopsis. Yeah,
this is for all y'all who are too lazy to read the feature. So She Kills Monsters is a play by playwright Ki Nien, and it's essentially about Dungeons and Dragons, specifically one school teacher named Agnes, who uses Dungeons and Dragons to connect with the spirit of her dead sister, Tilly. the only thing Tilia leaves Agnes on her passing, her kind of unexpected passing, is actually a campaign that she wrote for Dungeons & Dragons. So the play basically sees Agnes reading through this scenario that Tilia has read out and kind of imagining herself in this new world with Tilly fighting monsters. As a result, the play shifts between Agnes as a school teacher in Athens, Georgia, to suddenly being in this fantastical world where she's fighting monsters and doing crazy backflips and has magical powers. And it's a really insane experiment both in theater and just generally in escapism and in technical ambition. What makes She Kills Monsters really remarkable for UBC Theater is not only the play's content, the fact that we're dealing with female leads, one of whom is queer within the show, both of whom are biracial, traveling and fighting monsters in the kind of the context of Dungeons & Dragons. It's also the technical ambition of this show. There's so much stage fighting. There are puppets. There's like a lot of animations that are happening in this show. They're shifting between two very radically different sort of set environments and kind of vibes, like so, which requires a lot from the lighting team. The costumes are really extensive and often involve things like morph suits and really heavy weaponry is being added as far as props go. It's quite a spectacle, and it's quite an ambitious feat of a production. And this isn't something that we normally see necessarily from UBC Theater, which tends to go for things that are not boring.
Not
for
boring,
sure.
But like highbrow and like more like Beckett, you know. Like
yeah,
more
I, like, the classics per classics, se, yeah. Which is totally good and fine because honestly, you know, things like Beckett, things like Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller or The Crucible by Arthur Miller, The Crucible is actually coming up later this season, are really important shows to do in theater. They're important for actors to learn, and they're fantastic to watch. Everyone should go see those shows. But it's cool every once in a while to have something that is more contemporary, a little bit more experimental, a little bit more bold, and that is She Kills Monsters this season. Yeah.
Apparently, like, Forsythe, in the interview you had with her and, like, the article you wrote about it, she described it as, like, a bombastic interview.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, apparently there's a dragon as well, so I will definitely recommend, like, everybody.
Yeah,
should, like,
there is a dragon.
Like, even if, like, you're not...
It's on the posters, man. There's a dragon. like, she told me, she was like, this is not a spoiler. It is on the posters. There is a dragon in the show.
I mean, so some shows and movies kind of, like, you know, tease with, like, something in their trailers, and, like, they just kind of, like, just don't have it. So, like, it's good that, like, you know, they're staying true to that a little bit.
They're
like,
honest advertising. It's good to see. It's out there. Yeah. No, it is a bombastic production. What's really kind of cool about it, what Kelsey described it as, is actually kind of a bit of an homage to the 90s. Because, one, we're talking about Dungeons & Dragons, which, you know, it had fell out a bit of the cultural zeitgeist for a bit, and now is back thanks to Stranger Things. And the 90s was one that was really popping. Two, the play is set in the 90s. And funny enough, that's a period piece now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, although we
90s? That was like 20 years ago?
We were both born in that decade, and now it is a period piece, right? Like, you have costumes and set pieces and things that you associate with the 1990s. So for a costume designer or a lighting designer or a set designer, you have to actually take things into considerations now when you represent that decade.
Like, Freaks and Geeks, like Twin Peaks and stuff.
Yeah, you know, like high-waisted jeans, like kind of like baggy like Nirvana t-shirts, and like kind of like the whole grunge phase was coming through. People were listening to JT and like kind of really bad techno. Yeah, those were the 90s, man.
People listen to JT. People kind of still listen to JT.
Yeah, that's true. People still listen to JT. Justin Timberlake is kind of a universal good, man. But no, this was like bye 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 JT. You know what I mean? Like now we have like really cool sexy JT. Yeah, you know, we have mirrors JT. So
that's very cool. So you kind of like mentioned cultural zeitgeist and stuff, but I just want to like kind of like talk about I guess Kelty Forsythe herself. I kind of looked into the article, and she kind of described herself as like a huge nerd, right?
Yeah.
Kind of like learned how to like play from her like early 20s or mid 20s or so. And I guess that kind of prepares her. Like, she has a lot of expertise to tell this kind of particular story. Could you kind of like talk a little bit about that?
So it's no mystery why Kelty picked a play about Dungeons & Dragons. She herself is a Dungeons & Dragons player. And in fact, for the very first rehearsal of She Kills Monsters, before they got down into the nitty-gritty, right after they read the script, Kelty brought in five of her friends who are Dungeon Masters. Dungeon Master being somebody who kind of sets up the scene and runs the story of the Dungeons & Dragons, like runs the game essentially. So she brought in five Dungeon Masters, 2 pounds of dice, like multi-sided dice that are used to play the game, and everyone on the cast and crew just sat together and played Dungeons & Dragons together. And that was important, I think, on a number of levels, right? Because one, it shows that from the very beginning, everyone was very engaged in the theme of Dungeons & Dragons. Two, it's not normally for the cast and the crew to actually have that kind of experience with each other at the beginning of a show. Yeah. Normally, there's very little interaction between those unless something has to be done for an act. factor. Yeah. So the fact they're able to sit together and kind of bond and get and immerse themselves in this world that they're about to portray on stage was immensely helpful for them moving forward in the process. And I think it really speaks to the collaborative spirit that has gone into the show, it seems.
Thanks, Zach.
You're welcome, Ola.
Ooh, nice. Yeah, so like not only is it like far away because it's like not like any of the other stuff that's been produced before, right? Like you kind of like alluded to this earlier, right? But like it's also different in its portrayal of women and like, you know, expanded role of women in theater. You know, women are the ones doing the killing of the monsters.
Definitely,
you know,
yeah.
Like issues of like sexual identity, you know, like there's like a lot like queer women like leading, right? So you want to like kind of talk more about
Definitely. Suffice it to say, for anyone who's familiar with theater or even anyone who has a casual appreciation for theater, like if you read Shakespeare in your grade 10 like English class, you probably know that women don't often get to be the ones holding the swords in these shows. When there's violence on stage in traditional theater, it tends to be against women, often in the form of sexualized violence. So a fight scene for an average female actor is like the female actor gets slapped, which obviously portrays many problematic elements of our society, but also kind of is a bummer for female actors because while men get to do all these cool sword tricks and like learn how to do flips and fight choreography, they have to learn how to get slapped. She Kills Monsters turns that on its head. The two lead characters are both, in this case, biracial women. Like the role is open to people who are biracial. One of the main characters is queer in the show. And they all get to do all like the killing, and they get to actually swing the swords and do all of this stage combat that they wouldn't normally be able to do. And they're not the only women in the show doing this as well. And it's kind of actually really, really funny, like watching the run through, because you get to see the two actresses doing all these crazy like sword fighting maneuvers and stuff, and you get to see Heidi DeMaio particularly, who plays Tilly in the show. Heidi is a really energetic soul. But she's actually like a very small human being. Like she's playing, you know, a 16-year-old girl in this show. And yet she has such energy and such power and such ferocity on stage when she's moving in these fight scenes. And you really do believe that she's out there like slaughtering these monsters.
Slain. Yeah.
And there's something incredibly kick-ass about that to see like someone who's like, you know, the character portrayed is like a 16-year-old girl, and she's out there like slaughtering all these figures that are a lot bigger and scarier than her.
Yeah.
And I think that sends a really positive social message, and it speaks, and it's like kind of a daring move and an important move to make, I think, in this era. Yeah.
That's very cool. We're going to switch gears a little bit. Do you want to kind of talk about like, I don't even know any information about the source material. Just like, where's the play
some D&D
from?
Baby?
Yeah, well, I mean, we already talked about D&D, right? But like, like just like who wrote the play and where did it come from and like how did Kelty like stumble upon the play?
So the play is by Qin Yan, who is a very, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that absolutely correctly, honestly, but Qin Yan, who is a very acclaimed playwright, and She Kills Monsters actually came out, I think, like in 2008, 2007, so sometime back, and it's enjoyed kind of a cult success since then. Qin Yan is really known for making plays that kind of push these boundaries, that touch upon like geek culture, that touch upon elements of our society, of culture that aren't normally discussed at the level of theater. So She Kills Monsters enjoyed kind of a very cult success in places like Boston and New York. It was portrayed many times, got really rave reviews from places like the Boston Globe. And I'm guessing that's where Kelty probably came across it. And as we discussed earlier, Kelty herself is a huge D&D fan, not something she necessarily discusses at work, but it's something that it's like, you know, I think her partner got her into it, and it's just like it's a part of her life now. It's something she really enjoys doing. So finding a play like that, one, fits kind of her interests and what she likes to do. Kelty's a huge fan of fantasy in shows. She recently did a production of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis.
Oh,
she likes doing spectacles. She likes the bombastic and the magical and bringing that. Yes, bringing that into theater and bringing that onto the stage. She did a show last year that was about Greek gods and Greek mythology, and it was bringing that onto the stage. So she's really about that. So finding that show was just kind of a perfect marriage of a lot of the things that Kelty Forsyth is known for and a lot of the things that she enjoys. So it panned out pretty well.
Yeah. Do you have any more information about Kelty? Like, I don't know, like just the director.
Kelty, really cool lady.
Yeah. How do you describe Kelty? How did you meet her the first time? Yeah.
Yeah. So Kelty's returning director to UBC Theater, and she was off in Alberta doing some stage work and some theater work out there, directing a lot of shows, also acting in a lot of shows. She's a member of KIA Theater here in Vancouver, I believe. And as far as personality goes, Kelty is a very friendly, very warm, very open person. The way that she kind of treats her cast and goes about like working with her cast is almost kind of, it's very personal. It's very emotionally empathetic. Yeah. She's not like yelling at her cast, like, we need more of this, we need more of this. It's all about people being comfortable and feeling safe inside the space. She gives feedback in very measured tones. I don't think I've met Kelty, I think,
sounds
on
revolutionary,
three.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've met her on, I think, three different occasions now. And every single time she's come off as being very measured, very put together. She doesn't, you know, she prioritizes her actors really above everything. And that's something you have to respect in a director.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah. So just going back to just like the actual play, you kind of talked about in the piece how everything's like a feat, right? So like particularly you talked about like the choreography for like a lot of it. And like the choreography, at least from the words that you wrote, which are very good, by the way.
Oh, obviously, thanks. Obviously. It was a team effort.
But like your words are like, they like describe like, you know, the choreography. There's like a lot of like kicking. There's a lot of fighting. Like very like long. Obviously, not spoiling or anything, but like, yeah, there's like a lot of fight scenes.
There's a lot of fighting.
And they're
the
very well. Yeah. Like, she like hired like a bunch of like I guess martial arts people.
They have,
choreographers.
They have two fight choreographers in the show, and choreographer is a really important word because it is dancing. You are planning a dance, a very like strict sequence of motions. If someone messes up, you know, like someone actually could get hurt at the end of the day. Yeah. So fight choreography is really important. Cassandra Betts, one of the co-writers, actually did the section on fight choreography in the feature. And one of the quotes that we have from Natalie, one of the actresses, is that if you swing your sword the wrong way, that piece of metal could wind up in someone's eye. And the weapons they're using on stage are not like sharp blades or anything like that. They've obviously been blunted, but they are heavy.
They are still like weapons.
Yeah, they're not swinging around like little plastic swords on stage. They are weapons that are capable of hurting people. And a lot of the actors actually have really impressive histories of martial arts combat or physical activity. They're in very good shape. They're a very athletic cast. And they actually built more on that when they learned that they had the role. So I know for a fact that I think Heidi took up kickboxing, actually, when she found out she had the role, so that she could work on her footwork and get quicker. And she also does Jamaican dance hall and actually pole dancing as well. And one of the other sort of supporting characters is a karate black belt. So with her fight scenes, they incorporate a lot of kicks and like really swift, like fast moving motions and things like that. Like a lot of physical, like hand to hand combat. So that's kind of like the vibe that we're getting here, is that there's a lot of really intense, really bombastic fight scenes. Not like really gross fight scenes, but almost comic booky.
Yeah.
It's like you almost want to just scream out pow when they land that hit. But it's very, you know, it's intense. It's choreographed, right? Because if you kick someone too hard, if you like misstep, if you like don't forget to warm up on that day, someone could get hurt. So that intensity, those stakes bring a lot to the show.
Yeah, I remember like in the piece as well, you mentioned that like, you know, even though all these people are like, all the actors are like kind of athletic, you know, they're gymnasts, they're like fighters, they're all that stuff. Yeah. This is like a different kind of movement as well. So they have to like also just prep for that and like practice.
Definitely,
every single day they're like doing the like practices like every single day.
They spent, I think it was around half of their rehearsals, possibly even more, working strictly on fight choreography, which is unusual in any production. And part of that was that you're not just doing fight choreography as in, you know, sword fighting like you would in Shakespeare. It's Dungeons and Dragons. It's supposed to be bombastic and a little bit unbelievable and to be very flashy. So a lot of the fight scenes really reflect that, and they require a lot. They're very physically demanding, and they're very mentally demanding, just because you have to remember all of it.
Yeah, that's wild. So like you mentioned, like choreography, obviously, like the costumes and the props, like are also supposed to be like really incredible, because it's supposed to be like immersive, right? It's supposed to be like it really like puts you in this like other world, like where like isn't no longer like even the 90s, right? It's not today. It's like it's a period, right?
Yes,
so like
it's
supposed to be like just puts you there and like you don't come out, I guess, until like the end of the show.
Definitely. Right? I think that's really inspired by the vibe of Dungeons and Dragons. Like, we make fun of Dungeons and Dragons a lot. We kind of think of it as that guy who wore the fedora in high school. That's what he was playing in the back of the class, right? Like, you heard him like kind of like breathing heavily as he was tapping on his laptop, and you're like, what is he doing? But, you know, it's like, but to be real, like Dungeons and Dragons, like for those who have a chance to play it, is a super immersive and kind of escapist experience, because you're literally creating this avatar of yourself that allows you to do and kind of be who you want to be.
And you have like the same character like every single like time, right?
Like
basically if you die, you have to like be brought back to life or something, right?
You're building on this one character, right, throughout the entire thing, and it's kind of, that's a powerful experience. And that's what theater is about too, right? Both for the actors and for us, the audience. So when you're watching the show, it's kind of festival style seating. You're kind of in a ring around everyone. You know, like there's only one side of the stage that you actually cannot sit on. So you're on all other three sides. It's like a big, it just juts out and you're kind of encircling it. Because of that, you're really close to the combat. You're really close to the characters. You see everything go down. You see every motion, every movement, and you feel like you're in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And you feel you're quite literally like as little as like maybe a couple feet away from some of the actors during their fight scenes and during their motions. And that brings you in even closer to the show.
Is the show happening at Frederick Wood?
No, man. It's at the Chan Center.
Oh, okay. Because I was like, how did they turn the stage?
So, nah, bro. Okay.
So how did they do that for, I guess, like the Chan Center?
Man, like it's just the telestage and it kind of like juts out a little bit, right? Okay. So the way it works is that there's seating kind of in a horseshoe-ish shape, like a long, thin horseshoe. With one side of it being dominated by a set piece.
Yeah.
So that's the side that people aren't sitting on. And the stage is just very long and thin. And you just kind of like sit around it and encircle it and you see all the action happening. So from a blocking perspective, that makes their job even harder because, you know, sometimes like the audience might be seeing someone's back. So a lot of the time they have to block themselves very strategically in order to, so that you can actually see the actor's face and hear their voice. Again, like some kind of technical wizardry coming out of the show.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Do you want to like maybe give shout outs to like, you know, like the whoever is behind that? Or
yeah, some shout. I mean, shout outs to the whole tech team just for working. We still have to, you know, I'm saying very kind words about the show tonight because I've seen it. I've had the chance to speak to pretty much everyone involved with it. The team has had a lot of chances to be like really a part of this production as it's been moving forward, and we're very impressed by the amount of work they've put in. We'll have to see how it lives up in front of an audience tomorrow night.
Previews tonight, right?
Yeah, preview is tonight for a small selected group of people, and then tomorrow is going to be our actual review will be coming out of the show on Friday. So we'll reserve our final judgment until then. But I do think that the lighting team, led by Stefan Zubovic, I think that the puppeteer team, Nicolette Szabo, I think that the costumes team and all the techies really who worked on this show definitely deserve a shout-out just for the sheer amount of effort they have put in. It's something.
Cool. What's like the wildest story that you kind of picked up on in covering this story? Like what's the thing that like blew you away the most? Like you were just like, when you realized, you're just like, whoa, that's like incredible.
Man. Honestly, I think it's the very first kind of gut reaction I had was when I found out they were doing this show, when I found out this was happening right here on campus. It's not the fire hall. It's not the culch.
Yeah.
It's right here on campus on your, you know, on our, in our backyard, basically.
Making moves.
Right at the Chan Center. And I think this is a good reminder that even though we might think that UBC's cultural scene is kind of, you know, we've been there, done that, we've seen it all. We haven't been there and we haven't done it and we haven't seen it all.
Yeah.
There are new and innovative things happening here at UBC. They're cheap and accessible for students. And we should honestly go to them. This show is a really fun production. It's not really highbrow. It's something that you can enjoy no matter what your age, no matter what you're interested in, as long as you're kind of willing to let yourself loose and have a little bit of fun. And I think it's going to be a much needed distraction maybe from some of the stuff we have in our lives that we don't like dealing with.
Real life.
Yeah, from real life. You know, like you might be like really immersed in your studies and stuff. And you know now that you can go to the Chan Center, you can see the show for pretty cheap and you can have an amazing experience there. And that to me is a powerful reflection of the UBC community, of what is actually happening here. And it speaks to the creativity of UBC's theater scene and of the artists on campus.
Cool. So this is playing from January 18th, right?
Yes, sir.
Till
early February, my man. Early February.
Cool. So everybody can catch tickets and just watch it.
Okay, I mean, opening night is already sold out.
Yeah.
Congrats to the publicity team on that. Y'all did
fire.
Good.
Yeah. Fire.
Yeah. But you can buy tickets. They're $11.50 for students.
Yeah.
Which for theater in Vancouver is a very
especially Sheil Cole's Kills Monster, which is like probably never before seen.
This is a very expensive show, right? Yeah. And you're probably not going to see Sheil Kills Monsters attempted by a major company in Vancouver for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Just because it is that complicated and it is maybe seen as being kind of niche, but for our generation, it's incredibly relevant.
Yeah.
So they're going to take it on. This is probably your best shot to see this play in action. Go check it out, man.
Yeah.
All at it.
Any, other insights, observations, you know, comments
for other insights, general remarks,
general remarks. Anything you just really need to say, you know, that like you just haven't gotten the chance to say that. I've just been like interrupting you the entire time. You just got the chance to like
Man, you're doing great.
Thanks.
I guess the one thing maybe I'll leave off with is that it's really cool also, and or maybe not a reason why, you know, that's something that kind of blew me away about this show. Is the fact that this show is addressing issues that we can resonate with in our age group and in our demographic. I think I'm not alone in suggesting that theater is often seen as an art form not for people our age. It's seen as being created by an older generation that serves their problems and addresses their wants and their needs. That's not the case in this show. This show deals with a lot of aspects of identity, a lot of aspects of being young, a lot of aspects of growing older that we don't see in a lot of theater productions that are at least not this tailored to our demographic and to people like us who were born in the 90s or born in the 80s, maybe for some of the older folks out there. So that also to me means that it merits a shot. It merits you going seeing it. So if you haven't had a chance and to read the full feature yet and you want to get the entire story, please do. It's written by myself, Bridget Berner, Cassandra Betts, and Bridget Chase. Wonderful team at the UBC who were really integral in putting this entire production together. So please check us out. We're on the front cover, y'all.
Well, thank you, Zach.
Thank you.
You want to speak some French before you head out?
Okay. Bonne soirée tout le monde. C'était vraiment un plaisir de vous rejoindre aujourd'hui. Et voilà. Attendez avec impatience notre article, notre revue du spectacle. C'est vendredi. Et on se voit bientôt.
I'll assume you didn't say anything that's like, you know, R-rated.
Oh, I said some very dirty things. Yeah,
all right, thank you.
I was like, good night. See you soon. La bise. Man, like, everyone thinks I'm super pretentious already, and then you've got me on this program, like, you're like, hey, Zach, speak. Like, at the beginning, just so y'all know, I didn't want to speak French. Ola was like, hey, Zach, speak some of the French. And I was
I mean, you're already speaking French, and I was like, yo, you should say that on the podcast.
Man, I said it as a joke, though.
Yeah,
and then you were like,
but that's how highbrow you are, you know? Yeah. Like, you speak French as a joke.
Now, here's the thing. I'm middle brow because, like, I'm on one hand, I'm wearing, like, a blazer right now. But on the other hand, like, you know, catch me at your local punk show. Catch me, like, you know, bumping some Brockhampton in the back. I don't believe in highbrow, lowbrow. Yeah. I don't think that's, like, I think that's, like, a needless divide that often
we should all just be brow.
We should all just check out stuff that's cool and stuff that we like.
The things that you like.
And that goes for this show and that goes for everything at UBC, man. So don't feel constrained from anything. Just go live your life, man. Do your
hashtag
thing.
Do your thing 2018.
Hashtag new year, new me.
Thank you so much, Zach.
Thank you.
Finally. All right. Good night.
Good night.
And that was Zach Vissera, a culture writer at the UBC on the play She Kills Monsters. You can read more at ubc.ca. That's ubysseye.ca, not UBC. Up next, we have Sam Dubois to talk to us about the fun new things that are coming to the UBC. But first up, some PSAs and ads. Stay tuned and don't go away.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Is Coco Hamamatsu talking about koi fish in a pond or the youth at CITR and Discorder? Get info on your wares, services, or events directly to students, musicians, artists, and all the coolest cats from Bellingham to Squamish by advertising with CITR and Discorder on air, in print, or online. This can be your reality if you email us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit CITR.ca for rates and packages.
So you're a member of CITR and Discorder. But are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts in Kitsilano and around UBC at
On the Fringe Hair Design, Rufus Guitar Shop, Stormcrow Ale House, The Bike Kitchen, UBC Bookstore, Australia Boot Company, and so many more.
Welcome back to Cult, culture show from the University of British Columbia's campus newspaper, the UBC. We're broadcasting to you from the unceded Musqueam Territory, Vancouver, BC, the CITR 101.9 FM. Right now, we're going to listen to our interview with culture editor Sam Dubois on what's coming to culture, the culture section's new style advice column, that's pretty great, and the UBC's much-anticipated magazine. Stay tuned and enjoy. All right, Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, so with me right now, I have Samuel Dubois. He's the culture editor at the UBC and also the supreme cult leader of the cult podcast. Yeah. I guess we're like you should just say
hi. It's much more benign than that.
Yeah, what would you like describe your role, I guess?
Well, we don't drink Kool-Aid in my cult.
Yes. Okay. I think that's a very, very good thing to just like lay down as like groundwork.
None of that.
Yeah. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so I brought you here because I wanted to kind of talk to you about different projects that you're kind of working on for the UBC. Just like you're just juggling a lot of stuff. I don't know, you're a very busy bee, but you have your normal, you know, day-to-day regular content as the culture editor, right? And you also have the style column coming up, right?
Yes, we do.
With Jack Lamming.
Yeah.
And then we're also going to talk about the UBC magazine, right?
Yes, which is very imminent.
Yes. When does that come out?
February 6th to hit the shelves. We're doing production 2 weekends from now. I'm mildly scared.
Okay, cool. I'm just going to start from like the top.
All right.
I guess regular culture section stuff. What's coming to culture in the next couple weeks? Not just like what's like playing, what's music that's coming out, what's, you know, opera, but also like what's hitting the shelves in terms of like UBC content.
We got some pretty cool stuff coming up. Eve, one of our writers, she is working on a piece about how online review forums like Yelp or TripAdvisor talk about homelessness. There's a great article in The Atlantic talking about
that.
It was excellent about
just
how
like describe it.
it's based on the study which looks at a bunch of Yelp reviews in I think Brooklyn and talks about how gentrification shows up in just how people talk about these things. It could be just like, I love how clean and how nice this restaurant is. It was so awful before. Or where people deliberately like review badly places that might not look as like to the standard they've expected.
Yeah, like as a swanky.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, Vancouver is a city going through such an amazingly rapid gentrification that I was like, if it's that visible there, maybe we'll find something here. So originally we were just going to look at Gastown and see what showed up, and we couldn't find as much about gentrification just because a lot of people just don't write that much about on Yelp. Yelp is kind of not what it might have been when the study that The Atlantic was talking about was done. But what we did find was a lot of people were writing some pretty ignorant things about East Hastings and the homelessness.
Where?
You know that, I can't remember the road, but right off of Gastown, there's one which is, you know, there's a lot of homelessness there. Yeah. And for people who don't know what to expect, it can be quite a shocking experience. But I think what is important is that a lot of, like, when you and I might see something like that, we know the context, we know that these people are experiencing a very, you know, there's a lot of difficult things that are going on. Whereas what we see in the Yelp reviews is a lot of ignorance or lack of education. It's the sort of, this is a terrifying experience. I feared for my life. Never go here.
Yeah.
And that it's an unfortunate reflection. So what Eve has been doing is she's been hoovering up all of these Yelp and TripAdvisor posts about it. And she's going to talk to a sociology prof, kind of see like, what does this say about education of homelessness, education about these issues, and maybe how we can do better to, instead of say avoid these topics, avoid places like this, educate yourself and consider more compassionately what's going on.
Empathy.
Yeah, empathy, right? You know, that was the big thing they talked a lot about at the NASH conference that we went to, NASH 80 in Toronto, was the importance of empathy in journalism.
I don't think a lot of people know what NASH is. So
okay, NASH is this big student journalism conference in Toronto that a bunch of UBCers went to, and a lot of people who are actually getting paid decently to write journalism articles.
Yeah, to do journalism.
Yeah, people who do this professionally talked a lot.
Yeah, so I think Desmond Cole was there.
Desmond Cole, Robin Doolittle, yeah. who broke the Rob Ford.
Like Vicky Machama, I think, was there as well. So like, there's a bunch of like pretty interesting.
Yeah, it was very cool.
Journalists, yeah.
But they talked a lot about like there was one I went to. Do you remember the Dope Sick documentary from Vice?
Yes.
Yeah, the person who did that, she was there in lecturing about how to talk about the opioid crisis and things like that. And she was stressing, you know, it's always empathy. You can't, if you approach from a perspective of like judging or perspective of any, if you have any preconceptions, you're in trouble. You're not going to be good at your job. I think that's a good approach to life in general. And you see a lot of that in these Yelp reviews where people just instantly jump to conclusions.
Yeah.
Or because they feel uncomfortable with what they're seeing, they assume it's bad. Yeah. But yeah, so that's a very interesting article. Very excited to see that coming.
I'm excited to read that one.
Yeah, Eve's going to do a great job.
Well, what's the timeline on that one? Is that
I think we're aiming for probably the end of the week. She only has to talk to the prof next. So cool. Yeah, look for that soon.
Yeah, what's else on the pipeline?
We've got...
let's take your time.
Yeah. We've got MOA is doing for their night shift series that they do. Yeah. It's at usually the beginning of every month. They've got a group of indigenous women coming in to do a burlesque show where they're reclaiming their sexuality as indigenous women. Very exciting. Their night shift shows are really cool.
Yeah.
Like, I like what they're doing.
What is the night shift? Like, I guess it's like a long history of them doing, like, how many years have they been doing this?
It's actually brand new. Like, this year, last semester was the first time they did it.
Okay.
And, they close MOA off and they stay open late. There's a bar usually and a lot of kind of interesting art events. Yeah. DJs coming. It's like supposed to be a bit of a party. Yeah. MOA style. And they're really, really cool. Check out their website for more information. We've got a preview of the event coming up at the end of the week, I think. It's very exciting stuff.
Nice. Let's pivot to talk about your new style advice column.
Yes.
Do you have a name yet?
The name we're going with at the moment is Old Material.
Gotcha.
Courtesy of Jack Howen, who made it. Yeah, and the idea came from Alex Wynn, who's our news editor. And she was like, hey, you guys should do a good fashion column. And Jack Lamming knows a lot about, like, hype,
streetwear.
Yeah, he was
on the first episode of the UBC's Culture Podcast about Supreme and Hypebeastine. Now you can go check it out.
That guy loves Supreme. He loves Yeezy, all that stuff. And I tend to like more, like, old school fashion.
Bougie.
Yeah. I have no shame. I will admit it. So we're like, hey, we could, you know, pool our knowledge and do a good column. So the idea is anyone can write in asking for fashion advice on anything. And whoever is most qualified to give advice will chime in and write a little response to it. Could be myself, could be Jack, or I know Samantha McCabe, our news editor, was interested in contributing to it.
I mean, the UBC editors are very well-dressed.
We are a stylish
bunch. Like today I was walking through the office, and Natalie was wearing a blanket that's also like a cloak as well, right?
It's
and
awesome.
That's like,
I'm jealous.
That's like, we're all in 2017, and she's like in 30, like 17, you know? Like, she's like living her best life.
Natalie rocks that jumper thing. I don't know what it is, but I want one.
Yeah, no. So, what's the ideas for like the first column? Like, what's like the?
Well, we're getting people to like give us questions, but we're also trying to do an article on how you can steal Jeff Goldblum's style and do it affordably because. Like, we found three photos. He always wears this leather jacket, which is...
On, GQ or something.
Yeah, and it's a $5,000 Yves Saint Laurent biker jacket.
There you go.
You know, most of us cannot afford that, let alone tuition. So.
Yeah.
So instead, we might say, go to Urban Outfitters and get one that is leather and...
$20?
Like, 200 maybe? Or something. Okay. Like, there's a few options. If you don't want leather, if you want like vegan leather or something, there's plenty more options, which are much more affordable. Or there's this like GQ cover shoot he did last year where he's sitting next to his portrait from Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Oh, yeah.
You know the one. Yeah. And the jacket.
I actually just have a feed on my Twitter just like dedicated to Jeff Goldblum. Like,
he's a stylish guy. It's all like Prada shirts.
Yeah.
And then there's this jacket he wears in that, which is a $2,500 jacket. And it's a very niche one. So we're having trouble actually hammering down good alternatives. But that we thought that would be a fun one to start with. And yeah, it'll be just kind of like a good way to get some fashion writing out there.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
And yeah, I encourage anyone who has even the most outlandish fashion advice questions, send them our way, and we will do our best to act like we are an authority on the subject.
Do our best at being, like, highlighted.
Yeah.
Okay, let's switch gears to talk about the UBC's much-anticipated magazine.
Yes.
Do you want to kind of, like, talk about the ambitious idea and, like, how it came to be in the first place?
Sure, yeah. It's happening. The magazine it's a magazine.
That's for sure.
Yeah. It's in the works. Pages will have text on them.
Are you stressed?
I'm stressed. I'm keeping it together. I have an amazing team who's working on it. All of them very, very qualified people who are doing an excellent job. It's a tight deadline though. Yeah, we did the first magazine last year. If you haven't seen it, we have 2,000 copies hanging around the office.
My face is on it. Yeah. Your host.
Half of Ola's beautiful face is on the cover. Just for that alone, I encourage you to go and get a copy if you haven't already. But yeah, and then we were kind of looking at it for the second time. We're wondering, what are we going to do? How can we improve? How can we make this something really interesting and special again? Because it turned out amazingly last time, but it was pretty stressful.
Yeah.
So I kind of set aside time. I was very sick when I did it, but like in the haze of a fever, I wrote out this outline of how the magazine would work. We hired a team, pitched it to the board. Effectively, the theme this year is how we live, which sounds phenomenally broad and vague.
It sounds like a New Yorker, like, you know, like call for submissions or something.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Give you like how we live. Yes, very deeply conceptual. But no, we're going for like a kind of, like last year we did diversity, which I really liked a lot. And it was a very journalistic like piece generally. We had some poetry, we had some more memoir stuff. But I wanted to go very literary route, very New Yorker, very Atlantic. And I liked the idea of using people's stories, like specifically their stories, to talk about much larger ideas like mental health and diversity, accessibility, things like that. So yeah, there'll be a lot of first person, a lot of memoirs, some poetry. We got some amazing short stories. Our science editor Nivi wrote an awesome short fiction piece, which is going in.
Nivi writes fiction. That's pretty cool.
She also is a very good drawer.
It's like a multi-talented jack of all trades.
It's amazing. Yeah, but we've got a lot of talent behind it. We apparently have more content than we can actually put in the 54-page issue that's coming out. Yeah, and we go into production the weekend after next, which is alarmingly close.
Do you have any like sneak peeks, any cool stories you can kind of like talk about? I know you already mentioned Nivi's, right?
But
like any like for the audience, so they can be like super pumped about it.
We got a great piece coming in, hopefully on I think it's coming in tomorrow, on political correctness. I was working on a piece about architecture and how it affects like student well-being. Some amazing poetry. We have a recipes section. Nice. Some people have contributed. Kate, our video editor, is giving us her infamous baba ganoush recipe.
She always talks about it.
Apparently, authentic baba ganoush is very hard to find, and no one gets it right. And Kate knows her baba ganoush, so look out for that recipe. Yeah. And got some amazing photos. Samana is working on some cool photo series. We're doing like fashion people coming in, photographed in the clothes that make them the most like comfortable, like their favorite clothing.
So like sweatpants.
Yeah, exactly. just a onesie.
Yeah.
A onesie.
Cool. Do you have any like insights, observations, any new comments to add? Anything reflective? How's the journey been? I guess
it's been pretty good, actually. It's been remarkably smooth most of the way. Yeah, I kind of told all the editors, delegate, do this in a way that involves as many people as possible. And it's been, I think for everyone, fairly, like, not too intensive, not too stressful. Yeah, I've had very little to do so far, which I think is a sign that it's maybe working. Maybe, or maybe I'm just very checked out.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's going to be great. Hitting Shelves February 6th, if I didn't already say that. Look out for it. Yeah.
We're looking forward to it, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you, Ola.
All right. And that's the show for the week. Thanks to Bridget Chase, Zach Vissera, Sam Dubois for coming on the show. The music for this episode was Knock Knock by Poddington Bear from the Free Music Archive. The next show coming up is Rockets from Russia with Rocket Tim. If you missed part of the show or just want to check out other episodes, you can find our podcast on citr.ca. Don't miss us too much. You can find us later, 2 weeks from now. Our show is bi-weekly, so yeah, we'll be right back. I'm Alam Diolanion. Thanks for listening.
On January 26th and 27th, keep it short at the Vancouver Short Film Festival. Head to the Van City Theatre to enjoy 37 films by BC filmmakers and schmooze with up-and-comers in the local film industry. For more information, visit www.vsff.com.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
Do you want to voice this one?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Do you want me to voice it?
I can voice it. Yeah, yeah, please voice
That's
this one.
That's the wrong mic.
I forgot.
You f*** dip***. I can't believe I put up with this. And I asked for a grape soda, you a**hole. Okay.
Due to a labor dispute, CITR is missing its star voice actors. That means if you're interested in producing PSAs, advertisements, and various other promotional wonders for airplay on the radio, we need you. Learn how to get involved with CITR's production department and all other facets of volunteering at CITR and Discorder Magazine at CITR.ca. Programming, photography, media training, and more. Plus, a guest star in the lounge. No, wait, we can't promise that.
Can't believe I put up with this.